This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Vegetables live in oppression, served on our tables each night. This killing of veggies is madness. I say we take up the fight.
Good day.
Guten Tag.
Dude. Welcome to I Read the News Today, oh boy.
Or IRTN for short.
That's Stephen Benedetti. He's a permanent resident in Munich, Germany, where American liberalism is center-right politics.
And that's Matt Adams. If you can't tell from either the accent or the attitude, he's both a Canadian and an American citizen.
And today we are going to be talking about the Canadian election and all the contempt that happens. And speaking of contempt, we're going to be talking about the potential shutdown of the U.S. government, which at this hour has not quite happened. And if we have time, we might throw in a little foreign policy.
But before any of that, our regular feature below the fold, news you might have missed.
So in today's political climate in the U.S., we hear a lot of talk about the Constitution, including from yours truly, and the importance of American history. Well, some basic knowledge of American systems and history is required to pass the U.S. citizen test. So Newsweek magazine recently decided to see how Americans and citizens would do on the exam. Newsweek had 1,000 U.S. citizens take the official test, and the results are, while sadly not surprising, are sad. According to Newsweek, quote, 29% couldn't name the vice president. 73% couldn't correctly say why we fought the Cold War. 44% were unable to define the Bill of Rights, and 6% couldn't even circle Independence Day on a calendar, unquote. And to top it off, 38% failed the test. 38% failed the test. So the test is made up of 10 questions that come from a random pool of 100, and some of them are a bit obscure. To pass, one must get at least 6 right. So how did I do? I took 2 sample tests and got 100% on my first one, but flubbed 2 questions on my second, both of which I should have gotten. Total number of amendments to the Constitution,
ooh,
which is 27, and it's not
it's
not multiple choice. You have to name it. And total seats in the Congress. I'm embarrassed by that.
535. I was
going to say
518.
Still, unlike many Americans, though, that was more than a passing grade.
Very well played, Matt. I might have to go on there and try that myself. Maybe. Okay, so with me, I want to start with a couple weeks ago in Iowa. And this is a tough word for me to say. I'm going to try it. The Potawatomi County Emergency Management Agency wanted to run a drill involving all the various emergency services that would have to cooperate in the event of a real emergency. In order to qualify for federal funds for this exercise, the county agency needed to choose a scenario from a list of possible terrorist scenarios provided by the federal government. The one they chose had to do with armed white supremacists taking over a school. This choice was met with, get this, threats of violence towards the school and county from Patriot and Moser groups. In fact, due to the serious nature of the threats received, the entire training exercise depicting a takeover of a school by armed white militia folk had to be canceled because of a threat of violence from armed white militia folks. And if that's not enough to make your head spin, go to the linked article in our show notes and read the 200 or so comments to the article. They run about 20 to 1 in favor of the militias.
You can't make this stuff up. It's just amazing. So, like a lot of people who spout off about politics, we probably get a fair bit wrong here in the old prognostication department, but it looks like IRTN called it on single-payer healthcare. After, I think, the disappointing but still historic healthcare bill passed, we pointed out there is a provision to let states do their own thing in 2017, and that date might get rolled back, and then if it did, single-payer could be done at the state level, and that the state that would do it first would be Vermont. 3 for 3. Not the boldest prediction, granted, but we take victories here when we can get them. Obama is proposing moving the state date back to 2014, so that means practically states can start getting the ball running now. And the Vermont House recently passed Bill H-202, 89-47 vote, to move towards single payer. The Senate is expected it to pass, though it's not a done deal, and the governor will sign it. Rachel Maddow has a great bit on this that I found on Crooks and Liars and Steer Liner's notes, and I feel better already.
Good. The next piece was a little more below the fold a few weeks ago when I first read about it, but I'm going ahead with it anyway. It seems that the new pro-business Republican governor of Maine feels that the public art installed in the Maine Department of Labor's lobby was too pro-labor. According to the Boston Globe, Governor Paul LePage went so far as to say that the art did not mesh with his policy goals. So the 36 by 14 foot, 11 panel mural has been removed to an undisclosed safe location.
With Dick Cheney?
This has wrought a few odd reactions. First, the federal government got involved, saying that they laid out the $60,000 for the mural, and LePage has violated the agreed upon terms, so Maine owes the feds this $60,000. Second, 8 state Republicans have told LePage that this is actually going too far and have started trying to raise money to buy the painting from the feds so they can put all mural-related nonsense behind them and concentrate on what Maine citizens need. And third, the Tea Party, who more or less got LePage elected, has begun calling those 8 Republican state politicians traitors and trying to get them either recalled or defeated in the next election. I want to end this by noting what LePage's official comment through his spokeswoman was when asked about the controversy. He said, "We're focusing on policy right now." You gotta love that. He makes his social commentary decision, but when challenged on it, says policy and not social issues are important.
Ross Perot did well there. Enough said. So last week, oral arguments began at the U.S. Supreme Court for Walmart versus Dukes, the class action lawsuit around sex discrimination and pay for female employees of Walmart. The ruling won't come down until June or so, but legal scholars have said that things did not go well for the women, given the questions and tone from the judges, except, of course, for the silent Thomas. The question is, can such a large class of people form a legal class, that is, to sue? And some, like writer Laura Flanders of The Guardian, argue that this case could put into jeopardy the very act of class action suits, as the Roberts Court may be questioning the practice itself, at least as it has been used historically. So this is a very important case, and there are important issues to be explored here, and it's extremely complicated for, I think, lay people, but there is a quote-unquote plain language explanation on scotusblog.com that is worth a read, and you can find it on our show notes.
This is the largest class action suit ever, both in terms of the class suing and what they're seeking, right?
Yep.
I believe of both cases.
Yep.
Yeah, that, you're right. We do need to keep an eye on that. A new poll was just released surveying the views of Mississippi Republican voters, and I am left shaking my head. It's bad enough that Haley Barbour is using his experience as governor of the state as his launching pad for a presidential bid, but let's look at the opinions of his constituents. First, there was a question about how people felt about Roger Wicker, his likely successor, and 72% thought he was just about right, while 9% thought he was actually too liberal. The next question was if they could vote for Wicker, who 72% of them thought was about right, or if they could vote for Wicker or for an unnamed but more conservative candidate, who would they pick? And 39% of the people picked an unknown, more conservative candidate. So he's about right, but more conservative would be better. Which then, I guess, goes a long way to explaining how 46 of Republican voters in Mississippi think that interracial marriages should be illegal.
46%.
46% of Republican voters in Mississippi think that interracial marriages should be illegal, compared to 40% who think it should be legal, and 14% who just don't know. Not enough evidence, apparently. When I look at numbers like this, I wonder how we can ever come to constructive ideas or policies in the U.S.
Well, that's our mostly depressing news you might have missed.
We might have hit a nadir here. Yeah, that might be a record for us.
Oh well, we got in the single payer on Vermont.
True.
There we are. Well, good old Vermont.
All right.
Yeah. So, speaking of healthcare that might be disappearing.
Yeah. And actually, one thing I did when I was looking up that the information on the Vermont healthcare issue and the way that one state is starting with this one-payer system, and hopefully it'll work well and more states will pick it up. I was actually seeing that that's the way Canada came to a one-payer system overall.
Yep. And then now we're going to have an election and we'll see what happens.
Right. Well, this is it was about 2 weeks ago. I was looking through headlines and I came across just a headline email. I had time to read the story and I just copied it and sent it to you. It said that there was a vote of no confidence on the Harper government and there's going to be a new election. And I wrote to you and I'm like, Matt, you must be ecstatic. And do you remember what your exact phrasing was to me?
I think I said, dude, I'm nervous.
Yeah, that was it. It was a three-word email. Dude, I'm nervous, which I didn't expect from you. I thought you'd be very excited about that. But now having had time to look into it, I see why. It seems like there's a really good chance that Harper's going to go from running a minority government to running a majority government. Is that right?
Well, it's very hard to tell, but it's certainly a real possibility. And it's hard to tell because it's not as simple as doing, district by district polling, which the media doesn't do a lot of like they do in the U.S. and count all the congresspeople up. But they do a lot of sort of polling with the leaders and how the leader's doing and how the general feeling of the general public, and then trying to extrapolate that out to the number of seats people get. But the votes don't equal seats, and we will talk about that in a little while. But he's definitely in a good position. He's also vulnerable. It's a very difficult to say, and a lot of us are very nervous because he's done a lot of damage as a minority leader, and in terms of sort of Canadian traditions, it's been sort of this horror show of a death by a thousand cuts. And
10,000. But I'm not 100% clear on this. So the no confidence vote comes from – it's strictly a senatorial or governmental position. That's not voted on by the people at all. Correct.
No, the parliament votes on that. I mean, and the government was found in contempt for the first time in Canadian history for both having a minister who appeared to have lied to the parliament and then for their refusal of the government to release information to the other parties on budgeting and information they need to do their jobs. The parliament needs to do their jobs. And so it was an historic moment to be found in contempt, essentially contempt of Parliament is defined as any act of blocking the House or any member of Parliament from performing their duties. So refusing to testify, influencing a member of Parliament through bribery, lying to a committee or House. So that's what that's all embedded in. So he's found a contempt, and now we have this election, and it's 6 weeks long. It's not like the two-year-long election in the U.S. It's mandated by law when you can campaign and not.
Right, so the Parliament does the no-confidence vote and basically dissolves the leadership of the government. Then then it becomes a general election again. So even though the leaders of the various parties and the elected officials have found him unfit to govern or they don't have confidence in his governing abilities, it goes back to the people and not the actual politicians to decide who's going to be the next one, right?
Yeah, what's interesting too is I think my understanding is technically being found in contempt of Parliament, you could go to jail for that.
You could.
So
got to find somebody willing to put him there.
But apparently, that's quite all right. He can then turn around and become the prime minister again.
Well, it's interesting because in Germany, we have a parliamentary system, which is more similar, I would say, to the Canadian political system than it is to the American political system in terms of many parties and coalitions possibly being built, etc. And when there's a no confidence vote here, in the vote itself, when somebody proposes a no confidence vote, they have to put forward their candidate who they think would be a better person. So you cannot depose somebody without immediately electing the successor, which is a much different way to do it. So it doesn't go to the public.
And Harper's running desperately against the idea of the coalition, which he always did when there was a coalition being bandied about a few years ago, and then he prorogued Parliament. He's using it as this sort of
two times
this boogie monster. And I saw this great this great website page that said, you know, the boogeyman endorses the coalition because, you know, and the media did a terrible job. You know, people were writing me from, you know, the U.S. and other places saying, oh, is there a coup happening in Canada? No, there's not a coup. It's called the parliamentary system. You can have a coalition and it represents a greater number of voters. And this time, day one, he came out and said, let me be perfectly clear. Unless Canadians elect a stable national majority government, Michael Nadeau will form a coalition with the NDP and Bloc Québécois. Imagine a coalition of arch-centralists, I don't even know what that is, and Quebec sovereignists trying to work together.
You extreme moderate, you. it's unbelievable.
What he really means is the center of the country. But it sounds like ideological. Okay. Right.
I was going to say, is that before or after he made the comment that when he comes into power, he's going to make a Canada that you won't recognize anymore?
Yeah.
Is that before or after that comment?
Which is doing. I mean, you were telling me you're a bit surprised about, like, you've heard me complain about him, but.
Yeah, I hope you can put it up into the show notes, that link you gave me about sort of a history of Stephen Harper and his political machinations through the years. The number one thing I got from reading it is he kind of came across as somebody with Bush's political finesse along with Nixon's dirty deedness, you know? Like, I really don't think Bush was so into dirty tricks or anything. He was just like, I'm a bulldozer with my agenda and I'm going to push it through. And so Harper has some of that. And particularly the positions he holds, but it with like this Nixon, like Nixonian double dealing back room, I have enemies and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think my favorite thing that he's, and probably where I came up with the Nixon thing, was where he got, I want to say, scolded for having, for driving an all-terrain vehicle, an ATV on a runway somewhere. And when they told me, when they caught him and said, you can't do that, he goes, I'm the prime minister. I can do what I want. I make the rules. You know, it's like, if the president does it, it's not illegal. You know, Emma, who is this guy?
Yeah, no, it's incredible. You know, and then, you know, he's got this guy.
And we have to say, is lighthearted in terms of, when you go through the list and the things that he's done and the policies he's implemented and the things he wants to cut, the social system that makes Canada Canada, he's trying to eliminate.
Well, I think that's exactly what he wants to do. He wants his own version of sort of the U.S. or a more slightly different. And, you know, there's a lot. And the problem for me is I used to say this years ago, there's like a good idea border between Canada and the U.S. Like, somehow all the good ideas get stopped at the border and all the bad ones flow freely. Like, there are
both
some...
both ways.
So there's some really good ideas in the U.S. that he could absorb, but none of them, right? None of them. None of them, you know? And...
I've never heard that.
You know, like, wow. An Americans with Disabilities Act is a really good idea, but instead he's like, oh, I have an idea. Let's slash taxes and engage in foreign acts of, you know, military acts and see what happens to our budget. And then cry when nothing's there and then cut things. Or, you know, he's got...
Let's say we're pro-family and cut family services.
Right. Or cutting services to immigrants, cutting services to women, hiring convicted fraudsters for his consultants, you know, as consultants for him. And, you know, he's supposed to be law and order, but it's okay to have a guy convicted of fraud, but that they knew about.
Well, this is something actually, it was sometime last week we talked quickly about I was surprised about your nervousness about it, and you told me that you thought you didn't want him to get a majority government because it's going to be too much. I was actually, you know, going through the Rabble page and I read I don't know how to pronounce her name exactly, Alia Ahmed's she's a grumpy feminist, she says, she writes for Rabble, and she also says that, like, it could be a good thing if he gets his majority government for much the same reason that, like, it could be a good thing with everything that's going on in Wisconsin right now, is like, it could be this final overreach, this finally he's going to try to do too much and it's going to wake up the people and say, hey, wait a minute, we can't let this go on. And I thought, and that's sort of what I mean, it's a horrible doomsday scenario sort of thing, but it'd be better for him to take this one big cut and for people to recognize it than this thousand cuts that you talk about all the time, wouldn't it?
Well, I don't know. That's what I'm going to tell myself when I'm crying in my beer, if that's what happens on the evening of May 2nd. But we live in a system where...
May 2nd, right after Labor Day. Yes. Right after International Labor Day.
Yeah, May Day.
Whatever you call it over there.
Well, but unlike in England and in other parliamentary systems where people cross the aisle and there's a little more negotiation, in Canada, it's much more lockstep party voting. And so with a majority especially, basically get away with... whatever they want outside of whatever public pressure they face. And so, yes, there'll be massive public pressure, but on the other hand, they're in power and they'll do a lot of things, and which all leads to, you know, why we need electoral reform here desperately. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that because Canada is a profoundly undemocratic, democratic country. It's sort of like the U.S. Senate is profoundly undemocratic when, you know, you've got two people, you know, representing one person representing Senator Feinstein represents 15 million people, and Senator Dorgan from North Dakota is representing 200,000 people, or whatever, 400,000 people. So yep. Here, you know, it's all you're voting locally for your rep, and that's it. And so, like, the Green Party has no one in Parliament, and so they were denied being part of the debates, even though they got a million votes.
What's the population of Canada? Sorry.
I should make you guess, but it's low 30 million. So about the
30 million.
About the population of California. So, okay. You know, you get as Fair Vote Canada, which I recommend people check out, you know, as they point out, the majority of people will have someone representing them that they didn't vote for in Canada. Like, that's the way it works. Because there's no proportional representation at all.
Yeah, and that's one from everything. You know, I am no Canadian expert. I've learned a lot in the couple years we've been doing this, you and I. But how much of a do you personally feel is how much of a problem is the Québécois and everything that happens in Quebec in terms of national governments? Because they seem to have a disproportionate power.
Well, it's a problem in the sense that there's historical issues around, like, should it even be part of Canada or not? And then there's a sovereignty movement, and I recognize the people for the right of their own determination. The problem, quote-unquote problem, I guess the word I would use is the math, the political math, is that you have a party that is highly concentrated in one area. You know, they get two-thirds of the seats in Quebec, the Bloc Québécois, with half the votes, and then... they're never going to win nationally, and so you have a major political party that's never going to hold national office, and so it sort of plays this weird, you know, has a weird results, and so you have a party that has no intention of having national power, pan-Canadian national power, not national power in Quebec, holding, you know, getting, you know, the NDP gets a million more votes than the Bloc Québécois, but the BQ will get twice as many seats. So, and the Conservatives get every seat in Alberta. This is Fair Vote Canada, but 65% of the vote. So that's the kind of thing it throws around, and which is why getting proportional representation is going to be really hard, because those groups that get lots of seats are holding on to those seats that would have to be giving those seats up.
Right. So do you think there's a greater chance of electoral reform in Canada or in the U.S. with you know, the electoral system there?
I think it's just like healthcare. I think it's going to happen locally, and proportional representation does happen in some parts of the U.S. And BC tried it, and Ontario tried it with a pretty weak, you know, the government didn't do much. But I think some province will do it. It'll start with some cities, and just like in the U.S., I think there's even an area in Texas that does it. Some town in Texas does it. Bless them. Bless their little hearts. And doing proportional representation.
Let me guess where they are. I'm going to guess around Austin somewhere.
Yeah, I think probably in the outskirts of Austin somewhere. A little Sodom and Gomorrah.
Nebraska does the proportional, right?
I think they might do some, yep. I mean, so I think that's what's going to happen. And then people will begin to see how it's more democratic, how they generally are getting better representation. But, you know, like the U.S. Senate. The U.S. Senate is not going to go anywhere. Obviously, that would be a major constitutional change, but it's not going to go anywhere. Why would any of these small states give up this massive amount of power that they get? And then they say, well, people are interfering in our local elections. No, Senator, it's a local election. What might happen in Canada is the reform of the Senate, and that's a whole other thing Harper's done, is he's decried the Senate, it's horrible, and it's undemocratic, so he's just stacked it full of a bunch of conservatives that he just appoints, and they get to have power. That's how great it is. And he said, well, he's kind of trying to poison the well. So, I don't know. The NDP wants to get rid of it, and...
In Canada, they poison the well, and in America, they drown it in a bathtub, right?
Yes.
Same principle.
Same principle. So that's what's going on. And now, as we speak in the U.S., they're attempting to shut the monster down, as they call it.
They're trying to drown it in the tub again, aren't they?
As we speak, Friday, April 8th in the morning, Eastern time, my time, 11:14. As far as I know, at this minute, the government is still open.
Yeah, let's quick do a quick little check browser there. Refresh, see if the government's still up and running.
The last time this happened was under Clinton with Newt Gingrich as the Speaker of the House, and that really kind of backfired on the Republicans.
I was looking through some historical stuff on this, and it said it happened twice under Clinton, and I remember the one big one. Do you remember the smaller one?
No, I don't. Okay. But that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Yeah, we'll have to go back. We'll have to look at that for next time so we're informed. But, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. They claim that government is both important and, we need it. And at the same time, they say, but we can shut it down. And it's only, who cares? It's only government workers. But yet people will be – there are certain people who are indispensable and they'll be forced to work. And they'll still get their paychecks, but there are other people who will then be furloughed, which the larger of the two Clinton shutdowns, apparently 800,000 federal workers were furlowed. They didn't, so I don't remember how long it lasted, but they didn't work at all. But then when the government started back up, they got back pay for the work they didn't do. So, like, one of the funny things about this is all about the budget, but this is going to end up costing the government more than it would if they just did, short-term fixes or found a fix. But it's going to cost the government money.
That's an excellent point, and also puts a lie to the claim that it's about money. It's not about money, and it's never been about money. The Republicans have magically discovered deficits, which they built. I mean, Clinton inherited a deficit, and Reagan was the master at creating gigantic deficits. And then Bush had it, and then Clinton inherited it, and he fixed it. And then we went back to another enormous deficit because we had tax cuts during a wartime. First time that there was not even a tax hike, but there was actually a tax cut.
And not only that, what bothers me so much is that he did that, and then the cost of the wars he never included in the budget. So it was never counted as part of the deficit or the debt, ever. It was like, that's extra. And so Obama puts it in the way it should be, and everybody's, look how much he's raised the debt. You know, it's like, no, he's doing actual accounting. He believes in math.
Right, and the Democrats and Republicans have always done deficit spending, and so, but there's this gross dishonesty about it. So now they believe in it, but what's really going on is they're doing an ideological stare off. What the Republicans really want is they want no funding to Planned Parenthood, even though no federal dollars goes to abortion, none, and 98% of Planned Parenthood's own budget goes towards family planning and counseling and support.
Hey, we want to keep this objective. It's 97%.
Is it 97?
It is 97%.
Okay, 97.
Don't go all liberal on me here, Matt.
Yep. The lamestream media here. And then, they're claiming it's spending cuts, and they want spending cuts, but they don't want to do spending cuts on the Pentagon, and they're demanding that, Republicans are budgeting more for the Pentagon than the Pentagon asked for. Excuse me.
Yeah, and they're funding weapon systems that they've said they don't want. They're funding an airplane that is outdated and that the Air Force says they don't want. But yet the pittance that Planned Parenthood gets or that NPR gets, they're like, we need to save money there.
Yeah, it's all ideological. They're all dog whistles to their base. But they're playing a very high stakes game here, a really high stakes game here. I mean, these are people's lives. There's hundreds of thousands of employees that ripples out across the economy.
Soldiers won't get paid.
Well,
theoretically, all about the army. What about our troops? But they're going to not get paid.
No, they can write an exception for them.
But so far they haven't. They can. They haven't.
And, I thought they were going to.
They'll get everything they need. They'll get their bullets. They'll get their housing. They'll get their food and water. But they won't get paid.
Hmm. Yeah, so you have your families back home, and they're actually not paid very well. So a lot of them live very close to the line, and they're not paid very well. In part, it's worth noting that the Democrats tried to raise some of their benefits, and that was turned down. It's just incredible, and it's possible it'll go down. My guess is that because of the one thing that Obama does well is run campaign, and he has he's the president, so you get sort of points just in terms of the media, that he'll look better in the public's eye. He'll take less blame.
I think so. And I think there's a propaganda momentum as well. Everybody, I don't want to say everybody, but it's pretty widely accepted that the Newt Gingrich Republican-controlled Congress came off as the loser in the Clinton shutdown in '94, and I think people are just it'll just carry over. They're like, oh, it must be the Republican/Congress's fault, not the president's. I think because our electorate is very uninformed. It's a secret, but
yeah, a lot of them a decent number don't even know that the Republicans only control the House. Yep. A lot of them think that Republicans control the Senate. A lot of them think the health care bill was repealed. In a way, this is part of what they're trying to do. They want to slow down the health care bill. They want to, because the federal workers aren't going to be working, they want to do, amp things up. They want to muck the works. And it's a very high-stakes gamble. And I think, I'm not sure that Boehner actually wants to do it, but they're torn between the sort of rabid base. And
there was one interesting article that said that Boehner might not have he might not even be a decision maker at this point. He might be not a dishonest broker, but he might not have the power to make decisions, and that's why the negotiations are going so badly. He's got to, every time a new position comes up, he can't say, okay, we'll go forward or not. He has to break off the discussions and go back to his Tea Party masters and his Senate people and try to come up with another position and go back again. He is definitely not a strong leader.
Yeah, no, he could be in trouble. Who knows? I mean, yesterday John Stewart, for his moment of zen, showed a so-called Tea Patriot, holding up a sign that said "Shut it down," and he's in full sort of revolutionary garb. And the reporter said, "So you want to shut down the government?" He said, "No, I'm just making a point."
The point is that they wanted to battle in gold lamé.
Yeah, I know. I think the point was make it smaller. But I mean, sure. But then if we really want to make it smaller, then why are they funding the U.S. Joint Forces Command, which Robert Gates said they don't want?
If they're trying to make government smaller, why are they trying to control things like gay marriage, abortion rights, and things like this? That is large government. That's Big Brother.
I know. I'm telling you. I hear you.
It is such an inconsistent position that it's laughable.
And then, what's considered a crime now is the Reagan 35% corporate tax rate is socialism. That's the Reagan rate.
Right.
That's a Ronald Reagan rate.
I was going to say budgets and things like that. Have you looked at the Paul Ryan budget proposal at all?
Yeah, see, that is awesome. It was so funny as all the Beltway media who drank the Beltway Kool-Aid the first day were like,
Beltway? Let me do it the Beltway way. Have you seen the courageous proposal by Paul Ryan?
It's so courageous. What's courageous? So he comes out.
Let's get rid of Medicare in 10 years.
Let's assume that there's 2.8% unemployment. 2.8% unemployment, which is below what the official sort of level is for these economists and the government. They want to get it, because they're worried about hyperinflation. They don't believe in near full employment. So they want 4, 5, 6 unemployment. And he's assuming 2.8. Where did that come from?
Okay. So right. And he has his whole budget based on this idea of 2.8% unemployment. And then he gets ridiculed for that. Then they go, okay, no, that's wrong. We're going to go with 7.9%. So they added 5% unemployment to it. But that's the only number that changes in his budget. Nothing else changes. But we have 5% more people unemployed. But nothing else changes. It's all – no. It's – magic unicorn poop, I think, is on there. It's what I think is on there.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we they didn't. And it's like, dude, you got to look at that Excel spreadsheet and add the addition part. You forgot the formula part. Yeah, unbelievable. And but what was amazing to me was not that someone would come up with a ridiculous budget, but that there was a unicorn budget that the media's like, it's so brave. It's so brave to make stuff up. All right, here's my budget. No taxes for anybody, but we all have puppies.
Well, except George Soros. We'll tax him.
Yeah, we'll tax him. And we all get puppies, and we get free school, and it'll cost 50 cents because we're going to tax Cheetos.
It's just like my idyllic childhood.
It is. And a lot of that's just, I mean, it was like a piece of performance art, and it really wasn't interpreted that way because people were like applauded it, and it was so interesting. And then they're like, geez, you know, I'm not sure
I want to see one of the potential Republican presidential candidates for 2012 say that this is the budget I want to enact. I would love to see that.
And what's so funny, incidentally, and I was going to talk about this in News You Might Have Missed, but it was too long ago. A lot of people don't realize this, but the first Republican debate for the Republican nomination happened. Well, and by happened, I mean it was canceled because there wasn't anybody. They didn't have anybody that they felt was serious enough. It was going to be hosted at the Ronald Reagan Library, and it was going to be nationally televised. And it was canceled.
Well, Trump would have gone. I'm sure Trump would have gone. Birther Trump,
the hairpiece. I mean, he's not running. God. He's just trying. He does this every now and then. He pretends to run. And then the media, which is, well, you know, they'll interview, a Republican pencil if it says it's going to run. And he's not going to run for president. He just wants to get on TV and boost his message. And now he says he's going to solve the – he's a birther. I mean, that's – even for Trump, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, there's I'm holding out my little ray of optimism that I always have that he's going to come out and say, okay, I've looked into it and I've solved it. He was born in Hawaii. It's over, you know. And
he might
maybe it would actually go away, I'd have to, you know, because every once in a while he does something that I'm all right with.
Like, I think he might do that only because it gets him even more publicity. He'd be like, look, I solved the birth issue. No, you didn't. No, you didn't.
Obama did when he gave his birth certificate in 2000. I've got no idea when he gave it up.
Yeah, it's just, but it's kind of sad. It's sad. It's like watching a guy that had like a hit in the 60s and then he goes on tour again and he's got like a really bad song he wants you to play. Or he's doing like a cover song or somebody else.
Sort of like two old college friends getting together every once in a while to talk
on the radio on some sort of like self-indulgent kind of political show. It's totally pathetic.
The only thing more lame would be like if old friends of ours sat around listening to it together.
I know it would be terrible. Like Kim and Nancy or I don't know who it might be, but Pauline, I don't know. Something like that. Well, we were going to talk a little about Libya, but I think we've run out of time. But we can talk about it next time, perhaps. But I think it's worth mentioning that someone's drawing up some impeachment papers for Obama on Libya because he violated the War Act, which he probably did. But so did Bush, Clinton, Reagan, and maybe Carter. But
Carter might be the only one who didn't, actually.
Well, I went into Nicaragua with some CIA agents. But that's not to say I wouldn't support a little impeachment. I'm not saying she'd be found guilty, but impeachment just means trial. Yeah. Like, presidents should use the Constitution.
The focus should be on jobs, my friend. Jobs.
Yeah, with 2.8 unemployment. Okay.
Right. Until we're at 2.8, focuses on jobs.
There we go. All right, that's probably a good place to end.
Yep. Okay, so this is Steve Mazzetti from sunny and spring-like Munich, Germany, signing off.
And this is Matt Adams from overcast and spring-like Toronto, Ontario. Till next time.
Till next time. Bye-bye.